This is XTP Media.
We ran a Gulf Coast country out of fuel. We were using 1.7 million gallons, and we had to bring in a very large super tanker and pump gas right to the base. And we were about 6 days from emptying it when the wharfs came to a stop.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 91 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is, of course, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to be back. And, of course, Gareth Stringer, the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource. Absolutely delighted to have you back today. How are you?
You're so happy you can't even say it.
I can't even spit it out through my false teeth.
No, it's really good to be back. It's been far too long since we've done this. That horrible thing called life keeps getting in the way. But here we are. And God, we've even got plans for another one after this.
I know.
Back on a roll, eh?
And how are you now? Because we're all aware you had a few health issues. How are things going?
Well, my shoulder's still rubbish, so I'm going to see my surgeon in a few weeks and see what he wants to do about that. So that's the worst thing of all, probably. Yeah. But yeah. God, we lost a family pet. That's the worst thing of all. Anybody listening who's got, you know, dogs, cats, or whatever it might be, knows what a heartbreaker that is. But hey ho. As I said, it's all part of life, and here we are.
Well, the upside of your shoulder challenging you is we get a bit more of your time. So I'm not saying I don't want it to heal, but it's been great seeing the blog, your 10-year anniversary, and a bit more activity on Global Aviation Resource as well.
Yeah, I've been doing lots of writing because I can't really do that much else. I think my wife probably would like me to have, I don't know, decorated the whole house or something while I've been off work. But that's not going to happen, unfortunately.
No, bad shoulder, can't reach, so, health and safety.
typing I can manage.
And Tim, you've been away as well, and we're going to catch up on our next episode a little bit more with some of your activities. But how have things been for you?
Yeah, pretty good. Like I said, you know, busy. As we record this thing, we're now in the run-up to the Paris Air Show. So that's the busiest time of the season for us. And there's no let up on the news, put it this way.
Yeah, and we're gonna pick that up very soon. As Gareth said, we've got a couple of episodes in the pipeline, so hopefully we'll be back a bit more frequently. But let's get on to today's episode. It's part of a two-parter, the second segment of which will be coming in about a month or so's time. But Gareth, do you want to introduce our guest and the interview?
Yeah, absolutely. A wonderful conversation with Mark Hazara, ex-United States Air Force. And the basis of this is that Mark is an extremely experienced tanker pilot, KC-135 stratotanker pilot, and had a long career, 24 years, something like that. Flying KC-135s, is passionate about what he did in the Air Force and tanking and its ability as a sort of force multiplier, and was just so passionate. Really, really good to chat to Mark, and yeah, hope you enjoy it. Mark Cassara, welcome to Extended. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from Utah.
Hey, it is great to be with you. I'm happy to do this, and always remember, nobody kicks ass without tanker gas. Nobody.
Well, this is a really good place to start, Mark, because when I look through the list of things that we've covered, this will be our 90-something episode of Extended, and across the few years that myself, Peter and Tim have been doing the podcast, we've talked about the F-18 Hornet, the F-14 Tomcat, the Eurofighter Typhoon, the Osprey, the Black Hawk, the Harrier. Now, this is all great, but none of these guys are really going anywhere. You cannot project any power without tanking, can you?
No, you can't, Gareth. And your listeners are going to, their minds are going to explode when I talk to you about how much gas we're dealing with here, okay? Believe me, Leonardo DiCaprio and Al Gore have nothing on the eco footprint I've got. Okay? Nothing, okay? A typical mission on a KC-135, we take off with 180,000 pounds of gas, which is 27,395 gallons at 6.5 pounds per gallon. That's more gas than a family will use in their car in 27 years. And I'm using that on one mission.
Now, that is mind-boggling. And you did it for 24 years, Mark, as well.
Yes, I did it for 24 years.
So that's a lot of fuel.
That's a lot of fuel, okay? And I think your listeners would really enjoy, you know, how did I get started in aviation? What got me going in wanting to be a pilot and being in aviation? And I'll tell you, it was donuts and Los Angeles International Airport.
Now, you told me in a message that you had very kindly, you just listened to our episode with Cheryl and Lauren, and that you were fascinated about their journey, and that yours started at the end of the LAX runway when you were 3 years old?
3 years old, okay? My grandfather, Andy, lived about 2 miles from Los Angeles International Airport, okay? And at that time, Gareth, there were still jackrabbits running between the runway, okay? All right? It wasn't what it is now, all right? But I was born in 1957. In 1960, 61, the 707s and the DC-8s are just showing up, okay?
Yep.
And the ends of the runways back then didn't have any fences. There were railroad tracks, and then you had the blast deflectors just on the fence on the other side, and that was it, okay? And there's a famous donut place in Los Angeles, real close to my grandparents' house, called Randy's Donuts. And if you've seen the second Iron Man movie, there's a scene where he's actually sitting in the donut, eating donuts. Okay? Yeah. That place has been there since 1953. So my grandfather would take us to get donuts, 5 cents a donut. We'd go down Manchester Boulevard to Aviation Boulevard, turn left at the light, and we would park there at the end of the runways watching 707s and DC-8s and Lockheed Constellations and Lockheed Electras.
It's a golden age.
Yeah, and they're going right over the top of my head, Gareth, at like 80 feet, okay? I mean, I could throw a donut in the engine for crying out loud, you know? And so here I am with my sister who's 5. I'm like 3 years old. My brother's 2 years old, okay? And every Sunday we'd go to my grandparents, and that's what we'd do. And I remember standing on the hood of his car as a young kid in my socks, and we were waving at an American Airlines captain who was just getting ready to take off in a 707 with the old J-57 water-burning engines, okay? And he opens the window and he like sticks his head and his arm out and he waves to us, you know, like, hey kids, enjoy the takeoff, closes the window, turns onto the runway and leaves. And I mean, you think getting like a trucker to honk his air horn is cool? I mean, yeah. This guy's waving at us as he's getting ready to take off. And that, truthfully, is when I said, I'm going to fly 707s when I get older. All right. And for 24 and a half years, I got to fly the military version of it. And that is my origin story for how I got started in KC-135s.
You never forget things. You never forget things like that, do you?
No, you don't. Do you forget the first time you saw an airplane and saw a jet go by?
No.
Nobody.
No, of course not. Of course
nobody
not. And it gets you. It gets you and stays with you forever.
Oh, man. And my grade showed it. You know? Because I studied airplanes when I was a kid. I built plastic model airplanes, okay?
Yeah.
And I did that to learn everything I could about airplanes. You know, lift, drag, thrust, everything. You know, I learned what bombs went on them, what missiles went on them. I learned about the pilots that flew them. Okay, Douglas Bader was one of my heroes. You know,
wow.
Because I thought, wow, if I lose a leg, I can go fly too. You know, but aerofueling history starts in England.
Yeah,
we owe a debt of gratitude in the aerofueling community to the English and Sir Alan Cobham, okay? He is the one who patented the first aerofueling system, the grappled line loop hose system. He is the first one to test this thing out. He kept it going through World War II. They even bombed his facility.
Yeah.
And he still kept it going, okay? And then after World War II, again, they kept it going through the Korean War. They used the looped, the grappled line looped hose system in Korea, and the aerofueling community really, really owes a debt of gratitude to the English. And just recently, I became Facebook friends with Chris Hornage, Peter Hornage, the test pilot who followed a Lancaster around in a Meteor jet for
fantastic.
12 hours. Okay, the first like jet refuelings and so forth, okay? And he told me about his dad. And it was just fascinating to hear all of these things about what his dad was doing and everything, you know? So, again, we owe a debt of gratitude to you guys. We had to go a different way, you know, to build the boom because it took 110 minutes to fill a B-47 through a drogue. And by Boeing, that's why they came to Boeing and says we got to find a faster way to do this, and that's where the boom system that we use in the States came about. And that's really a funny story. Maybe we'll get into that later on.
Now, listen, you mentioned the Boeing 707 and of course the KC-135 that you know so well. This is an aircraft which, and I am not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but this is. She will eventually, when she finally is no longer in service, whenever that might be, she is an icon of aviation, isn't she?
She really is, okay? And think about it, okay? It's been flying since 1955. The first KC-135 came off the line in 1955, okay? The airplane is 60 years old, will probably be 80 years old before we retire them. And it's been the aerofueling workhorse for the United States Air Force, the United States Navy, and our coalition partners. We've had to do a lot of modifications to it to upgrade it to, you know, the new avionics standards and so forth. But it's still flying missions today in Operation Inherent Resolve over Syria and Iraq. It's still flying missions over South Korea to keep Kim Jong-un on his toes. That airplane just keeps going and going and going. And like I mentioned to you, I wanted to fly 707s when I was 3 to 4 years old. I knew what I wanted to do. And I got to do it. You know, I didn't do really well in pilot training, but it ended up being okay. I didn't fly fighters. I got to fly the jet of my childhood dreams. How many people get to do that?
The 135 was the US Air Force's first jet powered tanker. I think I'm correct in saying
that is correct. It lost the competition, Gareth. It lost the competition back then too.
A lot of
people don't know that the Lockheed airplane won the jet refueling tanker competition, and the Boeing KC-135 came in third.
Was that the L-193? Was it?
Yeah. It looks a lot like your VC-10.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yes, you're right. The 193.
Yeah.
It looks a lot like the VC-10. Okay. You know, two engines on each side on the tail and everything. Okay. But Lockheed couldn't get the design off paper. And Bill Allen spent $16 million of his own money. And back then in the 50s, that was a lot of money. And he built the 380 prototype, okay?
Yeah.
In a walled-off section of a Renton plant, okay? And because he got that thing up and flying, and he put a boom on it, all right? He put like a KC-97 boom on it. They showed him flying and refueling a B-52, and that was what finally convinced Curtis LeMay, hey, the 193 isn't going to make it. We're taking the 135s, okay? But it came third.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
You mentioned Curtis LeMay. Am I right in saying that's because at the start of its career, the 135 was only really refueling America's strategic bombers?
That is correct, okay? That is correct, because you have to remember back then in that time frame, Gareth, the nuclear war is it's not a cold war, okay? It's like a warm war, okay? And for 5 years, I was on nuclear alert at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at Pease Air Force Base, with six nuclear-armed FB-111s waiting to get the klaxon to go take off and potentially bomb Russia, okay?
Yeah.
And back in the 60s, you have to remember, Gareth, we had airborne alert. It was called Chrome Dome, okay? And there was four different tracks that they went to. One was in the North Sea, north of England.
Yeah.
One was in the Aegean Sea, all right? And one flew up around between Greenland and Iceland and across the top of Canada, over the top of Alaska and back down, okay? These were 24-hour missions, and their offloads in the A models now were like 105 to 110,000 pounds, which means the tankers were landing with like 15,000 pounds in the tanks. And that's not a lot of gas, okay, in an airplane that's holding 170,000 pounds, okay? And that was when the old water wagons, we call them water wagons, the old fuel, water-burning J-57s were taking off as two and three ships, refueling the B-52s that were carrying four nuclear weapons, you know, just waiting to hear from SAC headquarters, you know, turn east and head to Moscow, all right? The Chrome Dome missions, I talked to a Chrome Dome pilot. He said they were really fascinating missions. They flew, in some cases, for 24 hours. They'd have seven refuelings at 105,000 pounds apiece out of Zaragoza, Spain, I think it was Fairford in England that they flew out of.
Yeah.
And then a couple of other places like Morocco and so forth that they flew out of also. It's an amazing history of this airplane for 60 years and the amount of hours that are on them. Okay. In spring of 2016, I was actually visiting England.
Yeah.
And I came home Space A on the airplane that was stationed at Kadena in the 90s that had my name on it, tail number 8874. I mean, what's the coincidence of that happening, okay? Right? In 1994, 8874 had my name under the aircraft commander's window, Captain Mark R. Hacera. I even showed a crew a picture of it, all right?
Wow.
But I wanted to see how many hours it had on it. It had over 24,000 hours and 6,000 landings in 60 years.
That's incredible.
Isn't that incredible? And it was still flying combat missions in the Middle East. It was actually on its way home to Florida, to MacDill, all right? And I just beamed as I was going through the maintenance records, looking at this airplane's code one every time it lands, meaning that there's no discrepancies. It's 60 years old. It's still flying missions. It's got new engines. It's got a new cockpit. It's got some new systems on it, okay? But it's, you know, it's like the Energizer Bunny. It just keeps going.
Bearing all of that in mind, Mark, and as you said, there obviously have been fairly fundamental upgrades to the aircraft. Yeah. But what is it about that original design and the original airframe that not just that's given it incredible longevity, but that makes it such a good platform as a tanker?
You know. Even I have an uncle who was an F-4 pilot, F-102s, F-4s, and then went into the airlines. And he always said, if it's Boeing, we're going. If it's Boeing, we're going. There was something about the airplanes that they made in the 1950s and 60s that they just keep going. Do your listeners realize that the last 727 sortie just flew like a couple months ago?
Yeah, incredible.
They just retired that 727. It had been flying that long. And the KC-135 is going to continue doing the same thing, Gareth. Your listeners, I'm sure some of your listeners have seen them at air shows and so forth, you know, and it's an airplane that was just really, really made well.
Yeah.
And has a lot of miles on it. Like I said, 8874 had 24,000 hours on it, okay? They're only designed for like a quarter of that.
Yeah.
Just keeps going. And because of modern technology, new engine technology, new avionics technology, we've been able to put things into the KC-135 and keep it going, okay? The best upgrade to the airplane, Gareth, without a doubt, and your listeners know this, is that CFM56 engine.
Yeah.
That is a game changer for us. That was we could offload 40% more gas and go into shorter runways just because we got an engine upgrade. And it was always the same. It was always the same, Gareth.
Yeah.
Our mission planning was so easy. 10,000 pounds an hour. That was our rule of thumb. 10,000 pounds an hour. I could do flight planning on the back of a napkin. I have to land at my base with 25,000 pounds, and I'm going to burn 10,000 pounds an hour, and I've got 130,000 pounds on the airplane, okay? And I could mission plan with all that, okay? It was that easy, all right? It was an incredible – the engine modification was really a turning point for this airplane. And again, it keeps going and going. They had to reskin the wings and strengthen the wings and so forth, but – that really made a huge change, okay? And I used to work at Rockwell Collins, who makes the Pacer Crag upgrade for the avionics. And I have a really funny story about this. They said, never, ever, ever take the navigator out of the KC-135. And we replaced him with GPS. Okay? Him or her with GPS, okay? And the first time I flew a Pacer Crag airplane, I was so used to hearing this voice behind me at this table going, oh, hey, you know, come 2 degrees left, increase speed by about 5 knots, and we'll be on time, and all that kind of stuff. And now I'm looking at it at an FMS, and I'm waiting for the box to go, talk to me, Goose. Talk to me, Goose. And it took a while for me to get used to not hearing, you know, a nav's voice behind me. But now, you know, the airplane – does well with the Pacer Crag. It's had all kinds of upgrades. We're at block 45, I think, now with the new liquid crystal screens, and the airplane just keeps going and going because modern technology has allowed it to do that.
Purely from a piloting...
Huh?
Sorry, you carry on.
I went through Tinker where they do depot maintenance on them, Gareth. It was crazy to see them like naked, their term, okay? I mean, they take all the paint off of them. They take all the avionics out of them. They take the wings off. They take the tail off. And literally, it's just a fuselage working down the line. Okay. Wow. They've said that they've had to make new parts for the airplane. They've got obviously the machinist drawings to do that because it's getting so old. And obviously the operating hours per cost is going up on the airplane and so forth because of that. But because of all these smart engineers and these people at Tinker that keep this airplane going, I can't say enough about the people at Tinker Air Force Base that have kept this airplane going and going and going for so long.
Yeah, it's utterly remarkable, really, isn't it?
It is. It really is.
Purely from a piloting point of view, what's she like to fly?
You know, you have to remember, and I tell everybody this when I do a lot of public speaking. If you don't remember anything I tell you, remember this one thing. President Eisenhower signed the check. Okay? It's that old of an airplane, and so it's pulleys and cables. It's not this, fly-by-wire like your Voyagers and stuff like that, okay? And there are times when you're kind of horsing the thing around. But it was really a forgiving airplane. It flew with all the pulleys and cables and the 1950s technology. It was really smooth to fly. About the only time that it was a little tough is when we were doing like the minimum interval takeoffs.
Yeah.
And for your listeners, what that is, the minimum interval takeoff, or MITO as we call it, was the Strategic Air Command procedure to get as many airplanes off the ground as fast as you could. And our spacing between airplanes was only 12 seconds. So there's about 1,500 to 1,700 feet between us. So we're flying fairly close, heavy weight. And if you got in the wake of the airplane in front of you, it could get pretty thrilling with pulleys and cables, okay? It got pretty thrilling, all right? There's a picture in my book, Tanker Pilot, that shows a wet MITO takeoff with all the smoke and everything and the one airplane's turning out. And sometimes, you know, you're like almost full throw one way on the yoke and then full throw the other way because, again, it's 1950s technology. But for the most part, the airplane flew fabulously. The pulleys and cables wasn't really a big deal. The only time it ever affected us was when we were doing a heavy receiver, Gareth, when we were doing like a C5, okay?
Yeah.
You really had to be careful with a C5 underneath you because it could really push you around. And we actually had a training procedure. Your listeners are going to love this. We actually had a training procedure when we were still training at Castle Air Force Base in California, where we hooked up with a B-52 and he would take the boom and move it all the way to the right.
Wow.
And my airplane would go into a 90 degree bank and he would follow us. And we do these clover leaves at 90 degrees. We'd level out and then we'd come back up at 2 G's and then he'd move to the left and we'd go into 90 degrees of bank again and come back down the other side. And we would fly all the way down the Northern California coast doing that. We call it the Whifferdale or the Whiff. Okay?
Wow.
And I had to do that, all right? I was going through school when we were still doing the Whiff, okay? And it was the most incredible thing. It was, and all it was to show you and build your confidence. Look, you don't have to always be at 30 degrees of bank. You can stay connected even at 90 degrees of bank. And the other airplane, your receiver airplane, if it's big enough, can drive you, okay?
Yeah.
And if your listeners go out and, like, Google the B-52 tanker Whifferdale, pictures of it will come up. It's pretty amazing.
That's extraordinary. And
if you like, I have one. I'll send it to you that you can show your listeners. But we went literally all the way down the California coast, Portland, all the way down to Mendocino, San Francisco, doing this crazy 90-degree bank refueling thing, hooked up. Hooked up.
That is extraordinary.
It is. And it's an extraordinary picture when you see it, too. But it was just to go to show you that, look, aerodynamics doesn't change. when you're 90 degrees of bank, you know, and you just have to, you know, watch your airspeed and watch your pull, you know, G and a half to two G's, and we would stay hooked up through the whole thing. And that was one of the things we did in training, all right? And when I first saw it, I went to the back and took pictures of it. I said, I can't believe this. I can't believe we're doing this. But it was still a lot of fun. That was part of our training in KC-135s. When you were upgrading to instructor, that was one of the maneuvers that you did. Incredible. They don't do it anymore. They won't let them do it anymore.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
But you mentioned your book, Tanker Pilot. Now, you know, full disclosure, my copy is en route, so I haven't read it yet. But what I gather, rather than just tell a bunch of war stories, although we all love that, it seems to me you've actually put a really positive spin on this, and you want people to maybe look at these and see how they can apply them to take positive lessons for their day-to-day lives. Yeah. Am I right in saying that?
That is correct. That is correct. The reason I wrote the book was because there was no book out there on air refueling. And I'm a veteran of four wars. So I've seen air refueling at the tactical level, operational level, and strategic levels of warfare. And there was no book out there on it. So when I retired from the Air Force, I thought, you know, I'd really like to write a book about this. The other thing about it, Gareth, is I had 4,000 color slides. And you've seen some of the pictures. Some of them are pretty spectacular.
They are.
And your listeners will get to see them, I'm sure, when you post this episode.
Yeah.
But I wanted to tell the tanker story from the Strategic Air Command days, being on alert, waiting for the klaxon to go off, and sitting in a concrete bunker with six nuclear-armed airplanes out there with what we called 2.5 megatons of thermonuclear attitude adjustment. Okay? I was fortunate that I had FB-111s with the short-range attack missiles or the B-61 bombs, okay?
Yeah.
But in the Strategic Air Command days during the Cold War, we had some pretty heady days, and one of the stories in the book talks about that. But it starts with my first combat mission leading the first Wild Weasel F-4G package into Baghdad. And what I learned from that about courage. And one of the airplanes, when we got to the end of the refueling track, didn't get all of its gas yet. And my job was to fill those guys to the gills with gas. So I kept going north with Iraqi MiGs launching out of a particular base called Medeisis Airfield, which wasn't that far away from us because we were in the central portion of Saudi Arabia refueling, okay?
Yeah.
But my job was to go north and make sure these guys were full of gas. The mission commander of that is a guy by the name of Lieutenant Colonel George John Boy Walton, and he and I have become good friends now. And believe it or not, Gareth, he kept in his attic his lineup card from that night that he wore on his thigh, that had all of his mission notes on it. He still has it. All right. Wow. And he sent me a copy of it. Okay. Because you never forget your first mission like that. All right. But I wanted to write a book about tankers, but I wanted to be able to say, this is what I learned from this experience. So there's stories about courage, resilience, relationships. There's even one on humor. My first combat mission, a Royal Saudi Air Force F-15 snapped the nozzle right off of our boom in a brute force disconnect. You could feel it through the whole airplane. And I was in the back taking pictures, okay, because we were watching the crew. So that story's in there. And so I wrote this book to show people at all these different levels, the strategic, operational, and tactical levels of war, that literally nobody kicks ass without tanker gas. Nobody. Any air campaign you're going to be involved with is going to have tankers. If there is a humanitarian operation somewhere in the world, it's going to involve tankers. The tanker air bridge is always the first thing formed so that you can get fighters and cargo airplanes and special forces airplanes to a particular region, okay?
Yeah.
And we're talking about unimaginable amounts of gas. So here's mission planning just for the F-15 C model, the light gray. It burns 8,000 pounds an hour at tactical speeds, but 2,000 pounds a minute in afterburner. Okay?
Yeah.
It holds three external tanks that hold 4,000 pounds apiece, 15,500 internally. So in afterburner, it can burn through all of its fuel in about 12 minutes. That's why you have tankers. That's why you have to have tankers, okay? A friend of mine flies C-5s and had to fly nonstop from Dover, Delaware to Mogadishu, Somalia.
Yep.
And he drained three KC-135s. He took on 324,000 pounds of gas turning the corner at Gibraltar. All right?
Yep.
I was the chief of the air refueling control team for the invasion of Iraq. I had two RAF VC-10 pilots that worked on my team. Fantastic guys. In 26 days, we transferred 417,133,000 pounds of gas out of the tanker fleet stationed in the Middle East. Wow. How do you wrap your head around 417 million pounds of gas? Here's how you do it. A Ford F-150 truck can make 2,685 round trips to the moon or 8 round trips to the sun on 417 million pounds of gas. We ran a Gulf Coast country out of fuel. One of the Persian Gulf countries that we had tankers in was not capable of producing the amount of gas we were using at this one base. We were using 1.7 million gallons, and the United Arab Emirates was only capable of producing 1.2 a day. We had to bring in a very large super tanker and pump gas right to the base, and we were about 6 days from emptying it when the war came to a stop. That's how much gas we're talking about.
Listen up, folks. If you want more stories like that, and I'm sure there's plenty of them, you need to get yourself a copy of Mark's book, and we are going to put all of the details on the post, because that's extraordinary, Mark. Listen, I've taken up quite a lot of your time, but before I let you go,
I've got plenty of time. I got all morning to talk to you, man. We're talking about airplanes, man. I got all morning to talk to you about you. I cleaned out the room. I cleaned the house out. Everybody's gone. We can talk for a long time.
Let's finish.
But I appreciate this. I know that your listeners don't have a lot of time. But anyway.
Let's finish.
You just have to have me back on, won't you?
Oh, well, that's easily done. That can definitely happen. Let's just wrap things up by talking about the future. The KC-46 has had a troubled history so far. It's been in the news in 2019 with aircraft being delivered.
Yes.
But it's now in the news again.
Because
we have aircraft grounded. Just tell us, how do you view the, where are we going to go from here? What does the future hold? Maybe for KC-46 and even beyond, if you have any thoughts on
Yes. Great question. And actually, I get asked this question a lot. Okay. The Boeing KC-46, as we all know, has had a very troubled history. There's a couple of different countries that fly it. Those programs were also over budget and over schedule. Okay. And yet the A330 just keeps going. Okay. Again, like an Energizer bunny, just keeps going and going, and it's doing really well. And just recently, I'm sure a lot of you know this, but Airbus and Lockheed actually signed a memorandum of understanding, okay? And there may be some competition for some of the air refueling market space, particularly the commercial market space. I was fortunate to brief Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Airbus shortly after the invasion, when I moved back to Virginia. And I told them, I said, this is Sluggo's dream tanker. If I were a tanker pilot in the future, this is what I'd want on it, okay? And our discussion lasted actually about 2 hours with both companies on that. The tanker is always the first airplane to show up in theater. You always have to have the gas. Why can't we put some of those sensing devices on it? It is always around a region. Why don't we have systems on board that can allow us to talk to each other and allow us to talk to the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance airplanes or the fighter airplanes, and do a lot of stuff completely calm out? I've talked to both companies about making it a kind of like a Wi-Fi modem for data links, but also for radio relay, because we're spread out all over everywhere. And now that is starting to get incorporated into the airplanes. And now that's starting to get put inside the KC-46 and the Airbus and so forth. So these airplanes, I think, are going to be able to do a lot more missions down the road, okay?
Yeah.
I think we're going to be a lot closer to threats than we have previously. A good example is down in the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, where air refueling is going on as we speak with B-52s, flying through there, and the Air Force KC-135s and KC-10s refueling them, doing that.
Yeah.
But the Australians also have an operation going on to watch what the Chinese are doing down there, flying their wedge tails and their P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol airplanes, which are all air refuelable. So tankers are moving closer and closer to some of these threat areas. And in fact, on the fourth night of Iraqi freedom, we actually did move tankers into Iraq. And you have to understand, the KC-10, the KC-135 didn't have any way of knowing if we were being attacked. We had to rely on the AWACS, the RC-135s that you have and we have and so forth to tell us, you know, when to get out of the way. But now these new tankers are equipped with a lot of this sensing. And so now that allows us to start collecting on an area and finding out what's going on and so forth. Aeromedical evacuation is a big thing for the tanker now, okay? Because we can fly critically wounded soldiers, airmen, seamen, right out of a region to Germany to the hospitals there, or to England, the hospitals there, or back to the States if we have to. So there's a number of missions that are going on. Unfortunately, the nuclear mission is starting to kind of raise its ugly head again now. And if all of you have been following the news, President Trump has pulled us, is trying to pull us out of that nuclear treaty, and I'm not going into the politics of that, but I will tell you my opinion, and this is my opinion. I'm glad he's doing it because I think there were some real mistakes made there. But again, the tanker mission is never going to go away as long as you've got F-15s that are burning 2,000 pounds a minute in afterburner. Okay? Or the B-52 burns 22,000 pounds an hour through its 8 engines. Holds a lot of gas, but it's burning a lot of gas, okay? And so Lockheed has actually already put a drawing up of what they call a low observable tanker. My hook hasn't quite set on that yet. I don't know why I'd need a low observable tanker. Some of the fighter guys are having a hard enough problem finding us now. But there may come a time where, because of where we place tankers, we may need some type of electronic jamming or some type of low observable properties, maybe. But like I've said earlier, nobody kicks ass without tanker gas. Whenever there's an operation going on somewhere, you are going to need a lot of gas. And again, I told Gareth this at the beginning. The air refueling community owes a debt of gratitude to the English, to the Royal Air Force, and Sir Alan Cobham. If it wasn't for Sir Alan Cobham and his brilliant team there in England, who created and patented the first air refueling system, the grappled line loophole system, where would we be? You know, we'd still need this, but he created Air Refueling Limited in October of 1934. It's been around that long.
Yeah.
And he perfected the hose and drogue system, and it's still being used today. Now, we have our boom system, but that was simply because it took 110 minutes to fill a B-52 up through a hose. It's long. We can pump 6,000 pounds a minute through our boom. Typically, the drogue is about 1,000 pounds a minute was our planning, our rule of thumb for planning, okay? I've had a B-52 hooked up to my tanker for 22 minutes. He took on 103,500 pounds of gas. He was flying nonstop from Castle Air Force Base in Merced, California, to Darwin, Australia for Pitch Black, an exercise we do down there. Air refueling is going to be around for a long time. Hopefully the airplanes that we have now, like the Airbus Voyager that the RAF flies, the KC-46, I have no doubt they'll work the bugs out of that thing, okay? And it will be a great airplane, and it'll go for a long time. Look how long 767s have been flying now. I'm a little concerned about finding manufacturing tools and panels, but that's grounded, okay? And I'm sure the Air Force is having a long talk with the folks at Boeing right now.
Sure.
You need to get your act together here. But we've got 4 airplanes that have been delivered, and they're flying training missions, and they're doing the things they're supposed to. The Royal Australian Air Force actually sent one of their Airbus airplanes here to Nellis during a red flag exercise, and went and did all the certifications for the B-1, the B-52, the AWACS, and everything. So now you're going to see your RAF airplanes refuel a lot more aircraft. The Royal Australian Air Force is going to refuel a lot more aircraft. I've heard that they're going to put booms on the Voyagers, but I'm going to have to go back and look at that. It's imperative that we have both booms and drogues on the tankers and that they're air refuelable. I can't tell you how many times that became a headache when we were planning the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, where I had a KC-10 that could refuel everything, and then all of a sudden a KC-135 would show up with a drogue on the back of it, and it could only refuel the Navy or the RAF. It was such a headache. Where now, it literally only takes about 2 minutes to go from a boom-configured airplane to a drogue-configured airplane. And I can fill that gas tank back up anytime I need to. And that makes all the difference in the world for planners. Believe me. And it was fun to have international airplanes come up behind you, you know, and come up on the wing, and you'd see all these different airplanes. And I always kept a camera with me in the cockpit. I had a camera and 10 rolls of film until I went digital, sitting on the floor beside me, because I never knew what I was going to see on a mission.
Mark, we're going to get some more of those pictures off you for the post. It has been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I can't believe this is the first time we've talked about refueling on Extended, and I'm sure our listeners are probably going to have plenty of questions following this. So I do think a second visit would be brilliant, particularly if there are some questions they want answering.
I would love to do a question and answer podcast with your listeners. I'm happy to do that.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll ask them, and then you and I can hook back up on Skype, and maybe you can answer some of those questions for us.
Would love to do that. And again, my book is called Tanker Pilot Lessons from the Cockpit. It was published by Simon & Schuster about a year ago, and it's available on Amazon, and I'm sure there's bookstores over there that probably have it too. But
yeah, definitely.
But we'll really get to see a behind the scenes look from a guy that has done the planning, the execution, and the flying in four wars, and took pictures of it while he was doing it.
Mark, it's been brilliant talking to you. I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome. And again, thank you to all of you over there for keeping the air refueling technology going.
Well, that's a great place to finish it. Thanks again, Mark.
You're very welcome.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. The guys at Extended have kindly given me a couple of minutes to talk about our latest edition, TAH-27, officially published on April the 15th. Our cover story this time is actually a tribute to a remarkable old colleague, but I'll come back to him later. First, we mark Concorde's recent 50th anniversary, but rather than trot out the familiar history, we've got Professor Keith Hayward looking at its early Anglo-French political history. The politics took a decade to sort out. Shades of Brexit. Oh, I said the B word. That's 50 pence in the tin. Secondly, another major article in the issue concerns the Hawker Typhoon. We all know it suffered problems with catastrophic structural failure of the tail, but the fix involved much more than just adding reinforcing plates to the rear fuselage transport joint. Author Richard Seth Smith, who lost his test pilot father Kenneth in one of the accidents, uses contemporary documents and a recently rediscovered letter written by Hawker chief test pilot Philip Lucas to reveal just how complex the investigation and the solution turned out to be. Elsewhere in TAH-27, we explore Qantas's World War II Indian Ocean services using Catalina flying boats, Vought F4U Corsairs with the Argentinian Navy, Egypt's Hispano Helwan HA-300 lightweight supersonic jet fighter of 1964, which was designed by none other than Willy Messerschmitt, and a bizarre Jules Verne-esque French single-bladed reaction-propelled waterborne rotary wing experiment built before World War I, the Papin-Rui Giroptère. We also reveal newly unearthed details from the FAST Museum at Farnborough of a wildly ambitious British supersonic jet fighter design dating back to the late 1940s, which amazingly had swing wings, swinging tail surfaces, and you could swing the wing and tailplane on each side and back and forth differentially for longitudinal and lateral control. It was bonkers! Finally, coming back to the cover story, we pay tribute to Richard T. Riding, TAH's honorary grandfather, as we call him, who was the founder editor of my old magazine, Aeroplane Monthly, and who died suddenly in January. TAH truly keeps his boisterous spirit alive. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time then, this is Mick Oakey talking to Extended.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Gareth, you're never going to get anyone more passionate than Mark Azara on flying. I mean, you couldn't stop him at the start of that interview. Just such an engaging character.
Yeah, totally. And one of those people who is an absolute joy to interview. And I was sitting there for some of it thinking of you, thinking Peter's going to kill me because I know this conversation, I'm not going to want to stop this conversation either. So, Peter, I know you always love it when Tim and I say, I've got a quick interview with somebody, it's just a couple of hours long,
it's airplanes. We don't mind.
And it's great to speak to somebody who, has got that experience from his time in the Air Force. But, he speaks a lot about defence and does, I think, consulting work and everything. And Mark, he's obviously very up to speed on, the sort of current tanking environment, for want of a better phrase as well. So that's really nice. You get the full spectrum then.
Yeah. And the KC-135, of course, the 707 airframe built so robustly. Talking about the life, the aircraft that he picked up on the way back stateside a year or two ago, had 26,000 hours on it, 6,000 cycles, something like that. Do you think we'll ever see aircraft with that sort of life expectancy again?
I have to say, I think it's extremely unlikely. And KC-135 is on that sort of list, isn't it, of, B-52, U-2, just these aircraft that for whatever reasons, and I think you summed it up, it's, the sort of quality of the build and the fact that they got it so right at the beginning that nothing's replaced them, and they're still robust and in service now. And yes, a lot of them, maybe a little bit less so, slightly less so with the KC-135 compared to maybe B-52 or U-2, but they're like the old sort of grandfather's axe, aren't they? It's had 10 new handles and 12 new axe blades on it, but it's still it's still kind of the same thing. And it is extraordinary, and it's really hard to envisage us building aircraft like that anymore.
I think part of it though comes down to over engineering of those days, in that the engineering tools and the fatigue life wasn't that understand. I mean, it's a bit like the DC-3 as well that keeps kind of trucking on. And then it wasn't really understood. So basically, you built it, you over engineered it, you built it as strong as possible, and there's extra weight in there that if you were designing it today, you'd take it out, you'd be good. Well, what are you guys doing? This thing doesn't need. So, I think that's probably part of it, is that they didn't know what they were. I say they didn't know what they were doing, but there wasn't the computerized tools of efficiency and CAD optimization that you have now, and obviously things now like 3D printing, where the whole thing is take as much weight out as possible, and really sort of keeping it close to the close to the bone as possible. In those days, it was build it and build it strong, fuel cost, things like fuel cost, nobody thought about it.
Yeah, he talks about the CFM engines and what a difference they made. But you look back to that sort of pre-Cold War, sort of late 40s, early 50s designs. I mean, this is an airframe that's 50, 60, even longer, possibly years old. It's a bit like the old Russian aeroplanes. They weren't built for the finesses of today's airline industry. They were built for hard, rugged surfaces. They were built for poor weather. And that's given them a longevity, a bit like the KC-135 here and the B-52, that we're just never going to see again. And when I was listening to Mark, I was thinking, do you know what? Is that such a good thing that we design things the way we do for such a short-term view on, as you were saying there, Tim, weight and immediate operating costs versus the return that the airframe must be giving them now?
It's the same with cars, isn't it? If you look at an old car, you know, it's built out of metal and it's solid. And, you know, and if you look at a car, pretty much any modern day car now, crikey, you know, they look like they're just going to fall apart. And I know if something hits them, and I know a lot of that is to do with, you know, its safety and its new materials and things like that. But it's just almost a completely different manufacturing process, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, the weird thing is with the B-52, you know, people are sort of saying, oh, it's going to be a 100-year bomber. But, it's outliving the it's going to outlive the B2.
Yeah.
You know, the B21 is kind of come in and replace the B2. B52 is still going to be there because it's basically a big, huge, big bomb truck. You can put cruise missiles on. You can put sensors on. You can put anything. You know, all these other new stuff that's coming in, that's in the pipeline, like, you know, hypersonics, what have you. Yeah, we need a big solid truck of an aircraft. Yeah, B-52 will do.
Yeah, Tornado is an interesting example because that is an aircraft that internally, in terms of its systems and sensors and electronics and the weapons it could drop, developed an incredible amount over the course of it, the course of its career in Royal Air Force service. But the airframe itself, the fundamentals and everything, just literally ground to a halt, you know, and it doesn't matter how up to date everything is on the inside. If you're struggling to maintain aircraft or get them, you know, or basically keep them flying. And I'd be really interested to know, actually, a B-52 is a good example, you know, what it's sort of cost per hour maintenance and, you know, is that, and how much that's potentially changed if it has over the course of its lifetime. I'm assuming it's still perfectly reasonable. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, and I think they're re-engineering it, or thinking of re-engineering it again. But let's talk about the successor to the KC-135. As you said there, Gareth, Mark has a quite an amazing knowledge, not only of the experiences and the time when he flew and operated the aircraft, but what's going on in the industry now. I want to come back and ask some questions about the Voyager, but do we think the KC-46 is going to be a suitable successor to the 135? I mean, sentimental four-holer and all those sorts of comments aside, it's not got off to a great start. I'm sure that's overcomable, but do we think that's the KC-46 will ever be as successful?
I'd be interested to hear Tim's. I don't know if Tim got any. I genuinely don't know because we haven't talked about this beforehand, whether he got any briefings on this when he was in the States. Yeah, a troubled program. It's a modified, correct me if I'm wrong at any point, Tim, militarized 767 airframe. I read they've now just delivered 11 aircraft. I think they delivered three more last weekend or last week. I think I saw that on Twitter. But within the last, 6 months, I think the acceptance process has been stopped once or maybe twice due to FOD issues or quality issues that the Air Force pointed out. I think the Air Force has also withheld quite a lot of money potentially from Boeing for sort of, you know, I don't know whether that's a sort of protest or whether it's because the aircraft thus far hasn't lived up to the standards it was expecting. But hopefully this, you have to say the program will, God, it has been troubled, but hopefully it will continue to grow and, you know, deliveries will carry on and hopefully the aircraft will have a long and successful career.
So, yeah, I mean, what can you say? I mean, the KC-46 tanker. I mean, from some respects, it seems like it's cursed. I was in the US not last week, the week before, and yes, KC-46 briefings were on the agenda. I mean, the good sign of it is, you know, there is a guaranteed contract with the USA Air Force, you know, that so they're going to be delivering all those, you know, obviously, you know, they've got a guaranteed domestic customer there, so it is going to replace the KC-135s in service. The bad news is, as you know, Gareth has outlined, they've already had two stoppages of deliveries when FOD was found in inside aircraft from the USAF. That's not a good advert. And the other thing is, the USAF says they want to try and redesign something on the remote vision system. Two cameras. So the US Air Force is not happy with how that's been done. It needs a redesign. That's again. So I mean, you know, the briefing where they were outlining the move forward. It's going to be certificated or approved to refuel the whole load of different aircraft. Obviously, the US, everything in the USAF inventory, Typhoons, you know, Rafales, you name it, and their major selling point appears to be, well, the US taxpayer has paid for it. You know, you don't have to. Unless you're operating something extremely weird and wonderful, you're not going to have to pay for it. US taxpayer has paid for this. All the upfront costs have been borne by the Pentagon. So that is their sort of main selling point. But having said that, you know, the issues they've got with quality control, and you know, probably got over that now. But you know, the USAF. Still having reservations, redesign needed. It's not a great sell at the moment for foreign customers, you know. That's the problem. I mean, but again, you've got a big enough domestic customer with the US that's not really a problem. The interesting thing, though, is, you know, KC-46 was for KCX. There is also a KCY. And further in the future, KC-Z coming up, tanker programs. KC-Y is for the, I think the KC-10s. And what's interesting with that is that Lockheed Martin has partnered with Airbus to provide extra tanking capacity as a commercial sort of entity using the Voyager.
Yeah,
for U.S. military customers. So that suggests to me that, you know, one, somebody's realized that the KC-145s are going to start coming out of service maybe faster than expected, and there's going to be a gap, and that there is going to be some sort of tanker gap going forward, and that commercial providers are going to have to come in to cover the cover that difference, or that is Airbus partnering already with Lockheed for, you know, Tanker Wars Part 2, you know, this time it's personal, you know, KC-Y, here we come, you know, so watch this space as this.
And also, in case anyone wasn't aware, a contract has been, I believe, signed for the TriStars that are at Bruntingthorpe to go over to the States as well. Now I saw that, and they will potentially be used by a private contractor to provide provision of refueling for the military in America.
Brilliant. Oh, that would be brilliant to see.
Not sure how many aircraft they've bought, but Carl, my colleague, sent me the document they put out saying, yeah, this is happening.
And I sort of caught in the tone of Mark's voice in the interview when he was talking about this. I could be wrong, and he may have been trying to flatter us because we're European, but he sort of, I think, quite likes the Voyager. He sort of hinted that it was a good product from his perspective.
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't listened back to the interview for a bit, but I think he did some work doing some assessments on the project, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, he spoke to them both.
In the States, yeah, and he spoke very, very positively about the product. And as somebody with his experience, you'd think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Has your copy of his book arrived yet? Because I'm keen to hear what it was like.
No, it hasn't added yet, to my actually. List. That is coming from the States. You just reminded me. I need to chase that up, actually.
Yeah.
But my postman's reading it.
No, I'd be. I think I'm adding that to my list as well. And I know Mark has done a few speeches on the circuit as well. He's a great speaker, and we did talk there. We did talk to him about some questions that he may be prepared to come back to.
Yeah, definitely. So if anybody listening to this has got a burning question for Mark, whether it's about anything he said specifically, or whether there's anything you want to know about the KC-135 or air-to-air refueling or anything on, you know, on that subject, then please, you need to drop us a tweet, a comment on the website or the Facebook, and let us know. And I said to Mark that anything we got, he and I would arrange a time, another couple of hours, and we'll put those questions to him, and he'll be more than happy to answer them.
Do you know what? I wouldn't mind finding out a bit more about some of those stories he hinted at in the interview there. So,
post on our Facebook page, I'll make sure.
I will ask that question. I will.
Well, don't try and go around the back door. You have to go through the proper channels.
Right, I will. I will. Okay, that's it then for today. We'll be back very, very soon. So do stay tuned. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and his team at the Aviation Historian. They really do help promote the programme. So thank you very much, Mick, for all your support. If you feel able, please leave us some feedback on iTunes or whatever your podcast playing app is. Like our Facebook page and score us on our Facebook page. We recently got some feedback from new listener Sam Coombs. So, Sam, thank you very much for your feedback. And it came back from a podcast player we didn't even know we featured on. So sometimes it's just useful to get that sort of feedback. So please do leave us feedback. Don't assume just because you've listened for a while that we do get that. We don't always. So nice to know you're all still there. You can find Extended on all popular podcast players, including, as Sam has now reminded us, Breaker, which I didn't know about.
And maybe the ones we've got no idea about.
I don't even know how they get hold of us. But thank you very much again, Sam. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence. So where can we find us all on social media? Tim?
Yeah, okay. You can find me on Twitter at RESTimR, and the Royal Aeronautical Society site is www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth, where can we find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer, and GAR is globalaviationresource.com. It's our 10th birthday. We're going to be putting out loads of features to celebrate. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that next time. But yeah, please visit the site. There's a bit more new content on there now than there has been in recent months.
Yep, it's looking very good. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and lurking around on our Facebook page under both my real name and, of course, representing Aviation Extended. You can also find me on the Aerospace Podcast group on Facebook, where we try to encourage all other aviation and aerospace podcasts. We also encourage sharing aviation and aerospace videos, videocasts, programs, films. So if you're not a group member there and you're on Facebook, do come over and say hello. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth.
See you next time, folks.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.